Hello and welcome to this week's edition of the Herald podcast, normally recorded in our studio at the Bishopbriggs Media Centre, currently recorded from our volunteers' homes. To keep in touch with us, use our social media platforms, Facebook, Instagram and Twitter, which are all at Q and Review. That's CUEANDREVIEW, or get in touch via information@qandreview.com. That's information@CUEANDREVIEW.com. Please like and share our podcasts and give us any constructive feedback.
Recorded from the Herald on the 8th of June 2022, from the sports section, recorded by Amy. Fraser Forster to join Tottenham on free transfer from Southampton. Tottenham have announced the signing of England goalkeeper Fraser Forster on a free transfer from Premier League rival Southampton. The 34-year-old will join Spurs on a two-year contract on July 1st following the expiration of his Saints deal. He is expected to provide backup for Hugo Lloris in North London and most likely to play in the domestic cup competitions. "This is a fantastic opportunity for me," he told Tottenham's website. "When a team like this comes along, it's impossible to say no. I couldn't get here fast enough to get it done. Everything about the place is world class. The stadium is probably the best I've ever been to. Ask any player in the Premier League and that's what they'll say. The training ground is unbelievable. To be able to come here and work hard, I'm very privileged. It's an opportunity I'm very grateful for." Forster made 162 appearances over an eight-year spell at St Mary's, including 24 outings in all competitions last season. He has been capped six times by his country, with his most recent call-up coming in March. Forster travelled to the 2014 World Cup in Brazil and was also part of the Three Lions squad for Euro 2016. Having begun his career with Newcastle, he spent time on loan at Stockport, Bristol Rovers and Norwich before two successful season-long stays with Celtic resulted in a permanent move to the Scottish club in 2012. He joined Southampton 2 years later and, after losing his starting role in the South Coast, returned to Celtic Park for the 2019-2020 campaign before later returning to favour under Saints boss Ralph Hasenhüttl. Tottenham finished fourth last season under Antonio Conte to secure a Champions League return following a two-year absence. "It will be a fantastic season, fantastic to have Champions League football," confirmed Forster. "Having achieved that, I'm sure the club will want to go as far as they can in the competition. I've played almost 50 European games, so if I can come in and help in any way possible, that's what I'll be looking to do." That article was by The Herald. Recorded from The Herald on the 8th of June 2022. From the sports section, recorded by Amy. Kilmarnock set to replace James Fowler as head of football operations, by Ewan Payton. Kilmarnock are set to replace James Fowler as their head of football operations, according to reports. The Killie hero looks to be ready to step down from his role ahead of the new campaign. The Scottish Sun say that Rugby Park hierarchy are carrying out a management reshuffle. This will involve Fowler moving on from his role as head of scouting at recruitment at the Ayrshire club. However, the 41-year-old will remain at Killie, but in a different position, which has yet to be announced. Fowler has been in his current role for around 2.5 years. He played over 500 games for the club and also been caretaker charge on two occasions. It is understood that the majority of Killie's first team will report back for medical tests on Friday before some further fitness work over the weekend. Pre-season will commence next week with a trip to Inverclyde on the cards. That article was by Ewan Payton.
From the Herald Scotland, Wednesday the 8th of June 2022. From the Voices section, letters. Will Nicola Sturgeon be able to keep a straight face when Douglas Ross turns up at FMQs? Correspondence from our letters page. As regular readers of your letters page will know, I am not a fan of the SNP, its leader, and failed policies causing untold damage to Scotland. However, I was left with no option yesterday but to resign my membership of the Scottish Conservatives following a further flip-flop from Douglas Ross, withdrawing his support again for Boris Johnson. Ross accused of doing a donut as he calls for the PM to go now, The Herald, June the 7th. It is very clear to see that Douglas Ross could not lead a church service, never mind a supposedly mainstream political party. At a time when Scotland's political opposition should be holding Ms Sturgeon's feet to the fire, they're instead navel-gazing, looking inwards instead of outwards, and working out what position they might adopt this week. It will be very difficult for Nicola Sturgeon at this week's First Minister's Questions to keep a straight face when Mr Ross gets to his feet. And before Labour Party adherents get too far ahead of themselves, mainstream political journalists would do well to remind the likes of Sir Keir Starmer, Emily Thornberry, Lisa Nandy, David Lammy et al. That they campaigned tirelessly at the last general election to a Putin representative in the UK, aka Jeremy Corbyn, to be the next British Prime Minister. Don't let them forget that and be careful what you wish for. Richard Allison, Edinburgh. For months now, Douglas Ross has swithered and dithered and flipped and flopped, his support for the Prime Minister waxing and waning. The excuse for Mr Ross's first U-turn was the Ukraine war, but now he's made his second U-turn, although the Ukraine war still rages. Boris Johnson remains in Downing Street, for now, but after doing his U-turn on a U-turn, Mr Ross's arrival as leader of the Scottish Conservatives looks a lot more precarious. After all, it is no mean feat to make yourself look even more ridiculous than Mr Johnson, but that's exactly what Mr Ross has managed to achieve. Ruth Marr Sterling. MPs are not worthy. Even before the vote, it became increasingly obvious that certain Tory MPs would prefer to keep their positions rather than vote out an individual who happens to be our Prime Minister, who seems to think that the old school tie and a pat on the back is sufficient to keep him in post. These MPs are worse than their boss and spineless individuals. They are not worthy to represent the British public. Neil Stewart, Balfron. New leader must be found. I fully support my MP John Lamont and the other Conservative MPs who voted against Boris Johnson. Most Scots now see Mr Johnson as a Reichsgunner. Our bellicose Foreign Secretary and other Cabinet Ministers claim that it's time to draw a line and move on. No, it isn't. With 40% of Tory MPs having no confidence in the Prime Minister, that is impossible. The PM must go. His supporters claim there is no obvious successor. That is the whole point of a leadership contest, to find a successor out of 359 MPs. History shows a dark horse can emerge to take the laurels. However, one good thing emerges from this imbroglio. It's democracy in action. Meanwhile, the SNP continues to impose a Stalinist grip on its politicians, preventing any dissent. William Lonsky, Lauder. O tempora, o mores. It is indeed a sign of the depths to which the Conservative Party has sunk that the majority of its MPs could not think of a viable successor to Boris Johnson and hope to save their seats by sticking with him. I sincerely hope that the British electorate sends him a very different message at the coming by-elections. A. Trombala, Stirling. If one of your strongest and certainly most vocal public supporter is Nadine Dorries, you surely must recognise that you're in serious trouble. Willie Towers, Alford. Hypocrisy over fixed penalties. Having watched the media feeding like piranhas over birthday celebrations, during working hours, and 148 MPs declaring that a fixed penalty fine branded the recipient an unsuitable for government, can we presume that any of the 148 or any media pundit who has received a fixed penalty for parking, speeding, or their child's absence from school will resign before the day is out? James Watson, Dunbar. Davidson agreed on Indy mandate. I would like to correct a factual inaccuracy from Walter Paul, Letters June 4th, in his response to my letter of June 3rd. He erroneously assumed that the SNP was my own party. Although it was very clear from the tone of my letter that I am a supporter of independence for Scotland, I was careful not to state whether or not I am a member of a political party, because it was not relevant to the point I wish to make. My point, that the Scottish people have already voted that they want a second referendum on Scottish independence, could just as easily be made by a representative of the Greens or the SSP. In fact, even a leader of the Conservative Party made this exact point in the not too distant past. For those who don't believe me, here's what Ruth Davidson had to say on the night of the Holyrood count in 2011. I think you have to take a look at what it means to be winning, and you don't get a referendum for free, you have to earn it. So if the Greens and the SNP, and if the SSP, or any of the other parties who have declared an interest in independence, get over the line and can make a coalition, make a majority, get the votes in Parliament, then they'll vote through a referendum. Perhaps Baroness Davidson can further clarify things for Mr. Paul in a way that I was not able to. She continued, that's what democracy is all about. It's perfectly simple. David Patrick, Edinburgh. I don't always find myself in agreement with Kevin McKenna, but his excoriating review of the SNP, the SNP are tartan Tories and they're not even hiding it, the Herald June the 6th, was bang on target. Congratulations for hitting the bullseye. Ian Martin Mulgay. Our NHS is better funded. Jill Stevenson, Letters, June 7, fails to understand that the main reason for the squeeze in the Scottish Government's budget is down to UK inflation and a high cost of living crisis caused by Brexit that Scotland didn't vote for. As Labour tries to outdo the Tories by surrounding Sir Keir Starmer with even larger union flags, it has given up on rejoining the EU. In normal countries, opposition leaders were united in encouraging people to complete the census in the national interest rather than undermining the exercise. Health and education are politicised by unions in Scotland and amplified by their media allies, to an extent that this is not the case in England or Wales. At the weekend, the outgoing EIS Chief Larry Flanagan, no SNP stooge, said a narrative had developed that education is failing, which is a completely untrue, as the Scottish education is way ahead of the English system. He added that although politicians keep referencing the PISA results to try to portray Scottish attainment in a poor light, there is little difference between the different jurisdictions in terms of attainment. Scotland's NHS is better funded and resourced to serve the population, with more GPs, nurses and hospital beds per head of population, resulting in shorter waiting lists and the like. The recent report, Resetting the Course for Population Health, published by the University of Glasgow and the Glasgow Centre for Population Health, assessed the UK Government economic austerity policies as the most likely contributory cause of people across the UK dying younger, with people living in the poorest areas hardest hit. Austerity blamed as good health ends at 46 for the poorest Scots, the Herald, June 7. Fraser Grant, Edinburgh. I was interested to see such an emphatic headline and even more stark content, which blamed Westminster for a good health slump in Scotland. Whilst your article itself was devoid of any real evidence of how or why Tory austerity was the root cause of such a slump, and indeed the methods of measuring this were barely scientific, it did instill in me a curiosity to find out more about the Glasgow Centre for Population Health, GCPH. A quick visit to its website confirms that GCPH is funded by the Scottish Government. In conclusion, therefore, a Scottish Government-funded public body has managed to find that the UK policy is to blame for worsening Scottish health outcomes, but apportions no blame to the body that not only funds it, but has huge responsibility for areas that could directly affect Scottish public health outcomes. Fancy that. Jamie Blacklards. And that was today's letter page. From the Herald Scotland, Wednesday the 8th of June 2022, from the Voices section, Stuart Whaton, the anti-racism policies that will embed a worrying ideology in our universities, by Stuart Whaton. As I write, universities across the country are developing seemingly anti-racist policies, practices and even jobs that will ensure us for a certain form of anti-racism is adopted into the heart of their mission statements and their procedures. Ironically and tragically, however, in so doing, they are adopting a racialised ideology that is highly contested, even within academia, something that is not only divisive but also repressive. Many academics maintain a liberal or colourblind view of racism, believing that we should treat everyone equally and, as the name suggests, refuse to see the colour of a person's skin as being of any relevance to how they should be treated. I agree with this perspective. You may agree with it. You may not. The point is that from the new racialist perspective of being adopted by universities, this approach is unacceptable, bigoted even, and potentially racist. There are Marxist academics and indeed race theorists who view racism in terms of class politics or question the centrality of racism to modern society. These perspectives are also, according to the new dogma, incorrect and potentially part of the problem. The correct approach to anti-racism can be seen in the various policies being developed at the moment, almost all of which talk about the importance of Black Lives Matter and the systemic nature of racism. These policies, it should be noted, are not the same side issue, but are becoming part of the ethical and practical framework for universities. It is a new correct outlook that risks severely limiting alternative ideas and perspectives from developing. Take, for example, the recent report commissioned by the government that questioned the systemic nature of racism. The man who headed this report, Tony Sewell, is a black man born in Brixton to Jamaican parents. If someone like Tony Sewell applied for one of the growing number of diversity and inclusion jobs, would he get it? Indeed, if an academic is to be promoted, especially into senior positions, he or she will increasingly need to be given a commitment to things like the need to decolonise the curriculum. But what if someone, like Sewell, questions the need to decolonise this curriculum and is unable to commit to the new approach? In our newly racialised times, university leaders and administrators would no doubt struggle with a black man like Tony Sewell refusing to promote BLM or adopting a racialised view of the curriculum, but he may well still get the job. Why? Because part of the Race Equality Charter aims to improve the representation, progression and success of minority ethnic staff. This approach appears, at least, to racialise employment and indeed employment prospects. This is enhanced by the growing acceptance of the idea of a person's lived experience being vitally important rather than their knowledge or expertise. The Race Equality Charter has been adopted by every university in Scotland. It is based on a racialised outlook and developed from critical race theory that denounces colourblindness and argues that we must see colour. At its heart, this approach elevates the idea of race and racism and promotes the idea we must understand society and ourselves through racial categories. From this perspective, the negative idea of whiteness has emerged, as is the idea that we must see the colour of someone's skin. It also, as one anti-racist critic argues, risks constructing a new caricature of black people as victims. Many of those developing these policies in universities know little or nothing about critical race theory, nor, I suspect, do they all necessarily buy into the identity politics of groups like Black Lives Matter. But the essential principles and practices of this outlook are being adopted. From a colourblind perspective, one that was promoted by Martin Luther King, what is important is a person's character, not the colour of their skin. Today, this outlook goes against what is essentially an ideology that has been adopted by universities. Today, academia is institutionalising the idea that we must see race. Some people that this undermines the very idea of equality. I'm worried that this is more victim-based approach will encourage a new type of cancel culture in universities. Agree or disagree with this new approach, any approach that is forced onto academics and indeed students should be seen as a serious problem, indeed as being anti-ethical to the open academic institution. Compelling people to adopt an ideology, however correct you think it is tyrannical. And that was an opinion piece by Stuart Waiton. Our columns are a platform for writers to express their opinions. They do not necessarily represent the views of the Herald.
Herald Scotland recorded on Wednesday, 8th of June 2022. Arts and Entertainments. Books. Anthony Horowitz is back with his latest take on James Bond by Herald Magazine. Fiction. Fight Night by Miriam Towse is published in hardback by Faber & Faber, price £14.99, ebook £8.99. Fight Night is absurd, overwhelming, traumatic, touching and totally delightful. It's a love letter to the woman in one family with 9-year-old narrator Swiv recounting life with her heavily pregnant actor mother Mushy and elderly grandmother Elvira. It moves at a fast pace which might initially make your head spin, as Swiv jumps from topic to topic, going on many adventures with her extremely fun grandmother, brackets, who is a brilliantly written character and a total badass, close brackets. While it doesn't always have a clear-cut plot, it deals with some big issues such as suicide, alcoholism and depression, with realism, dark humour and a lightness of touch. It's a joy to read, and the colourful and beautifully drawn characters will stay with you long after you've finished. 9 out of 10. 2. With a Mind to Kill by Anthony Horowitz is published by Jonathan Cape, price £20, ebook £9.99. With a Mind to Kill is Anthony Horowitz's third Bond book, and is a fast-paced thriller centred in a dangerous mission even our hero isn't sure he can complete. It opens with the funeral of M, head of the intelligence service, with Bond in custody accused of his boss's murder. The plot thickens when Bond goes behind the Iron Curtain to join a group of former Soviet intelligence agents who want to enroll the British spy into a daring plan that will change the balance of world power. Bond fans are in for a treat as he enters the Lion's Den, having to draw on all his powers to overcome the enemy. Readers will love the way Horowitz stays loyal to the winning formula of Bond creator Ian Fleming, confronting an old enemy with new energy. 8 out of 10. 3. You Made a Fool of Death with Your Beauty by Ikwaeke Emezi is published in hardback by Faber & Faber, price £14.99, ebook £8.99. Anyone who's read Ikwaeke Emezi's previous books, The Beautiful and Heartrending Fresh Water and The Death of Vivek Oji, will be in for a surprise with their latest offering. Well, You Made a Fool of Death covers some similar themes as the other books, including violent loss and love. At its core, it's much more of a popcorn romance novel. Faye is a young artist with a sad past, meaning new romance is hard for her. She tries to turn over a new leaf by going with a potential suitor to his island home, staying in his wealthy father's house. Things become complicated when she finds herself falling for the wrong man, quite a classic romance trope, meaning the book feels quite predictable. While Emezi's signature arresting style is there, the content isn't. They spend a bit too much time discussing how beautiful the main characters are, which can get a bit dull. It's no doubt readable and you do connect with the characters, but Emezi possibly suffers by comparison to their previous books, and You Made a Fool of Death likely won't stay with you quite as long. 6 out of 10. Non-fiction. 4. Managing Expectations by Minnie Driver is published in hardback by Manila Press, price £20, ebook £9.99. Celebrity autobiographies are always a very mixed bag, but this one from the actress who made her name in Circle of Friends and Good Will Hunting is a shining star among them. It's a collection of essays of key moments in Minnie Driver's life written with razor-sharp wit and tear-jerking pathos, from her parents' breakup to her wayward hair and her experiences in acting, as she dived from one successful movie, which she thought would secure her career, to faking orgasms for a chocolate ad to keep the wolf from the door. Her Oscar nomination for Good Will Hunting was robbed of its joy because of her ex, Matt Damon, who arrived at the event with his new girlfriend. But self-pity never washed with her mother, a stoic, funny, positive figure who wouldn't tolerate complaints about life being unfair, which makes the final chapter so heart-wrenching, as news of her diagnosis of terminal cancer leaves Driver literally on her knees in front of her shopping trolley in Waitrose. You'll want to read this book twice, laughing at the acutely sharp observations and holding back tears as the final chapter comes to its close. We hope this actress writes more. 10 out of 10. Children's Book of the Week. 5. Clarice Bean, Scram by Lauren Child is published in hardback by HarperCollins Children's Books, price £12.99, ebook £7.99. Lauren Child knows what goes through a child's mind and how to transfer those thoughts to the page. In her latest instalment of the Clarence Bean series, she delivers another snapshot of the topsy-turvy world of the title character. Clarice and her extended family adopt a stray dog, with the young girl forming alliances with siblings and somehow manipulating situations to her advantage, so everything turns out just fine in the end. Child made her name with the Charlie and Lola Pritchard books, and Clarice has firmly become a new favourite. You'll be left trying to work out if Clarice and family ate horrid spaghetti or something else entirely. See for yourself by reading this entertaining tale. 9 out of 10. By Herald Magazine.
From the Herald Scotland, Thursday the 9th of June 2022. From the news section, Buchanan bus station, search for man carrying box after package scare, by Emma Sabliak. Witnesses who saw a man carrying a cardboard box at Glasgow Buchanan bus station are being urged to come forward after a suspicious package prompted an evacuation. The bus station was cordoned off by officers on Wednesday afternoon after reports of a suspicious package. Kellermont Street, North Hanover Street and Cowgardens Road were closed to both vehicles and pedestrians while special officers attended. An official statement by the force released at 1:30 p.m. on June 8th confirmed there was no threat to the public. Police Scotland is continuing an investigation into the incident that caused extreme disruption. The force is looking to identify people who were near to Stance 22 around the time the alarm was raised at 12:15 PM. Detective Constable John Fagan of Greater Glasgow CID said, "The incident caused extreme disruption in the local area and we are continuing to investigate the circumstances surrounding the incident. We are appealing for anyone who was in Buchanan bus station around the time of the incident who witnessed a male carrying a cardboard box to come forward. In particular, we are looking to identify anyone who is near to Stance 22. The male was wearing dark clothing, a cream coloured cap, and had a black and white dog with him. Anyone with information is urged to call Police Scotland on 0101, quoting incident number 1299 of 8th of June. And that report was by Emma Sabliak. From the Herald Scotland, Thursday the 9th of June 2022, from the news section. Number 10 calls unions selfish over strikes that will cripple Scotland's railways, by Martin Williams. Downing Street has condemned plans for major rail strikes planned for later this month as selfish and an act of self-harm, as ScotRail warned it may not be able to run any services in any walkout. The Prime Minister's official spokesman has urged the Rail, Maritime and Transport Union, RMT, to call off the walkouts, which it said would cause lasting damage to the industry and those who work in it, and call for the issue to be resolved around the negotiating table. Talks between Network Rail, which owns the UK's rail tracks, stations and signals, and the union are expected to be held in the next few days. Up to 50,000 staff are due to walk out on a 3-day strike later this month, which would cripple Scotland's railways. The RMT union in Scotland says that a strike would not just hit cross-border services, but also the running of operations across the country, including ScotRail and Caledonian Sleeper Services. That is because those involved are safety-critical workers, including signalers and maintenance staff, employed by Network Rail, who are crucial to keeping trains running. Members of the RMT are due to strike on June 21st, 23rd and 25th, in an ongoing UK-wide dispute with Network Rail over plans to axe hundreds of critical management jobs. It's the biggest outbreak of industrial action in the industry in a generation. ScotRail has confirmed that as the strike affects Network Rail staff in Scotland, our services will be affected. The nationalised train operator said, "The impact is expected to be significant, with a limited service operating, if at all." It comes as the train drivers' union ASLEV is due to meet with ScotRail bosses on Thursday, as talks resume in a bid to end a separate dispute over pay, which has seen services cut by up to a half in an emergency timetable due to staff shortages. That dispute has resulted in ScotRail advising the Tartan Army to consider leaving the Scotland v Armenia Nations League match last night early because of the service cuts. The RMT says Network Rail is planning to cut at least 2,500 safety-critical maintenance jobs as part of a £2 billion reduction in spending, including hundreds north of the border. Meanwhile, workers have been subject to pay freezes and changes to their terms and conditions. Network Rail insisted no proposals were on the table, talks were underway about modernising maintenance and how compulsory redundancies could be avoided. It rejected claims it would do anything to compromise safety. The strikes fall during major events, including the Eagles at Murrayfield in Edinburgh, the Royal Highland Show, Biffy Clyro at the Royal Highland Centre, and a Barry Manilow concert at the Oval Hydro in Glasgow. Downing Street has said the strikes would be thoroughly irresponsible. A Downing Street spokesman said, "The key facts would be for them not to push ahead with these damaging strikes, which will drive people away from using the railways at a time when we already are seeing numbers down on pre-pandemic levels. It is a self-defeating approach which will do lasting damage to not just the railways but to the rail workers." Downing Street said it was working with industry on contingency plans to mitigate against the effects of the planned rail strikes. The Prime Minister's official spokesman said, "That includes working with freight companies and their customers to plan ahead to reduce the impact on supply chains. We are looking at prioritising resources towards key routes, deploying other modes of transport to cover any gaps. focus hours for freight trains. There is a list of approaches being worked through. Labour said the proposed rail strikes should not go ahead and called for the government to make a more active role in resolving the dispute. The Prime Minister described the rail strike action as reckless and wanton in the Commons. Network Rail is also drawing up contingency plans, with the strikes expected to cause disruption to services for 6 days, from the first walkout on Tuesday, June the 21st, to the day after the third strike. Fewer than 1 in 5 trains are likely to run, and only between 7 a.m. and 7 p.m, probably only in main lines. No direct talks are planned between the union and train operators, although the RMT said it is open to meaningful negotiations to try to resolve the dispute, and the Rail Delivery Group said it was willing to take part in negotiations. According to the Department for Transport, the average UK salary, rail worker salary, is £44,000. This is more than the median pay of other public sector workers, such as nurses, £31,000, teachers, £37,000, and care workers, £17,000. However, RMT said the salary figure was unrepresentative as it included higher earning train drivers who did not take part in the ballot, as most are part of a different union. The union claims its members earn £33,000 a year on average. Mick Lynch, Secretary General of the RMT union, hit back at the government, saying they were experts at being selfish and irresponsible. The Rail Delivery Group, which represents the industry, urged the union, Network Rail, and the operators to intensify talks to try to head off the disruption. And that article was by Martin Williams.
Recorded from the Herald on the 9th of June 2022, from the sports section. Aberdeen face waiting game in order to sign Celtic's Liam Scales, by Ewan Payton. Recorded by Amy. Aberdeen could be playing a waiting game to sign Liam Scales from Celtic this summer, according to report. The fullback is a prime target for Jim Goodwin at Pittodrie in the transfer window. Earlier reports suggest that the Irishman will look to secure a permanent deal. However, initial loan move could be on the cards. Now, the Daily Record say that the Dons could be made to wait for the man. It is said that Celtic will not allow Scales to leave the club while they wait on players returning from injury. Goodwin secured his first signing as Aberdeen manager this week, with Yilber Ramadan arriving for £100,000. The former St Mirren boss is also looking to reunite with Conor Ronan and Jamie McGrath in the North East. The report states that the Ipswich goalkeeper Vaclav Ladke is another target, as well as the soon-to-be-out-of-contract Blackburn midfielder Jacob Davenport. That article was by Ewan Payton. Recorded from the Herald on the 9th of June 2022, from the sports section, recorded by Amy. Rangers not interested in Stoke City left-back Josh Tymon, by Ewan Payton. Rangers are not interested in signing Josh Tymon this summer. It is the Rangers Review's understanding that the Stoke City defender is not on the club's radar for the upcoming window. Reports earlier this week suggested that Tymon was on Giovanni Van Bronckhorst's wish list this summer. However, it is believed that the Ibrox club are not in the market for a left-back. This rules out a move for the 23-year-old. Calvin Bassey and Berna Borasek remain Rangers' first-team options for the left-back position. Both players have been linked with moves away from Ibrox, but no bids have been received so far. Rangers' only summer business to date was the securing the signing of John Souttar. The centre-back agreed a pre-contract with the club back in January, with his deal at Hearts expiring at the end of last season. Conor Goldson and Stephen Davis have also agreed contract extensions to remain at Ibrox. That article was by Ewan Payton.
Herald Scotland recorded on Friday, 10th of June 2022. Arts and Entertainments. Best of Scotland. Author Nick Holdstock. I was as freaked out and worried as anyone else. By Paul English. The novel Quarantine began its journey into print 6 years ago, and yet has proved to be prescient in predicting humanity's struggle against a virus, says Paul English. The world as we knew it changed in 2020, but Nick Holdstock had been living in a pandemic longer than most of us. The Edinburgh author had been immersed in a world of vaccines, quarantine, face masks and highly contagious viruses since the days when Corona was still just a beer with a slice of lime wedged in the bottle. Nick first put pen to paper in his novel Quarantine 6 years ago, imagining a fictional scenario where all of humanity is challenged by the emergence of a disease which sweeps the globe. By the time the first draft was finished, his fiction had become reality with the emergence of COVID-19. When I came back to read it then, I did look at situations I'd only imagined and compared them to how things had actually been, said the writer. For example, I was trying to think of what it was actually like to be in an urban environment and being scared of other people around you because they were potentially infectious. I'd only really imagined that before, but now I had experience to draw on, thinking about how close I'd been when I walked past someone, for example. It was strange that I managed to imagine some things in a way that I eventually experienced them. Quarantine follows two main characters, Lucas and Rebecca. One is locked inside a containment camp on a mountain in Central Asia. The other is a virologist in New York. Nick said, "Lucas and everyone else in the camp are just waiting, trying to lead a normal life in an abnormal situation, waiting for a cure. Rebecca is part of a team who found a vaccine and who is living in New York, where life has got back to normal for people. But she's convinced the vaccine is only going to be good for so long and isn't over it. She has her own personal loss and trauma that she suffered during the disease. She's not relaxed and finds it very strange that everyone is carrying on, like now in a way." The experience of writing about a pandemic long before most of us had bothered to think about the reality of living through one didn't make it any easier for Nick, who has lived in Edinburgh for 20 years. Even with their cyclical nature, the London-born writer was no better prepared than the rest of us. He said, "It wasn't something I was thinking was necessarily going to happen soon, but all the pointers were there in terms of how we live globally. President Obama was warning about it in 2014. I'd like to say it protected me or made it easier, but I was just as freaked out and worried as anyone else. I don't think fiction made it any safer for me. I'd seen lots of pandemic-related films and TV shows, and you might think you have a certain familiarity in terms of how scenarios will play out, but most of us in our lives have not had to think about something so big, so uncertain, so ongoing, so it didn't really protect me. Watching all these films and TV shows gives you a mental script in terms of how you think it might play out, but when your own safety and the safety of people you love is jeopardised, there isn't much that can protect you from the very real dangers. Nick's imagined virus brings about life-changing illness more commonly associated with old age and those who contract it." He said, "When I started writing it in 2016, I wasn't so much interested in writing about a pandemic as I was interested in writing about people who had been left behind after something was supposed to be over, yet they were still having to deal with the problem. The disease was a way of thinking about that sense of being marooned after everything was supposedly fine." In that sense, Nick agrees, Quarantine's virus becomes a metaphor for everyday challenges life many of us face without daily briefings or mandatory lockdowns. "It's about how you recover from things, when do you get over things," he said. "It's about something that has a long tail emotionally, whatever it is, being bereaved, getting divorced. It's that sense that you have to carry on and get on with your life, but yet with that feeling of something persisting, even when it's supposed to be over." The legal requirements about the wearing of face masks were relaxed earlier this year in Scotland, but the characters in Nick's novel wear coverings for a different reason. He said, "I hadn't thought much about how important masks might become to all of us. And there's a thing in the book where people keep wearing masks even when they're supposedly safe. They use the mask as a way to remember people who died because they have the faces of the dead people on them. That's not something we do now, but the idea of the mask becoming like a ritual to make people feel safe, that was kind of strange." There are also prescient references to China's response to the emergence of the virus in early 2020. "I have a background as a China expert, so it wasn't a big stretch for me to imagine China being able to do something as drastic as control a huge border," said Nick, who's written several books on human rights issues in the country. His previous fictional work, 2015's novel The Casualties, explored humanity's reaction to another global catastrophe. He said, "It was a story about a meteorite hitting the Earth and ultimately making it a better place. So if a meteor comes in, then you'll know who to contact." With COVID cases dropping, in the UK at least, and all restrictions lifted, how does Nick feel having spent more time than the rest of us grappling with the world during a pandemic? He said, "I don't feel great about the current global stage of the pandemic, especially in the UK. I don't feel it's over, and don't have a lot of trust in authority and their current tactics. I have the sense that they're still rolling the dice in some way. There are a lot of things that I still haven't done. I still don't go into busy place without a mask, and I haven't been into a restaurant for a very long time. Yet for his characters in quarantine, there is a hard-earned hope. He said, there's a sense that there will always be baggage for what they've been through, and as for reality, there are some parallels between me and Rebecca in the book. I walk around seeing people in restaurants and I think, I'm not ready for that yet. But I think there can be positives, and I have hope. Hope that we find an equilibrium, and hope that we don't have any new terrible strain, he said. Maybe now we have a sense that things were more precarious than we realised. Our relationships, how we work, what we work, we do. On one hand, it feels like it has been going on forever. On the other hand, it feels like it's too soon to say. Quarantine is out now, published by Swift Press. NickHoldstock.com by Paul English.
The Herald, Friday the 10th of June 2022. News. COVID Scotland. Cases start to rise but rate uncertain. This article is by Jodie Harrison. COVID-19 infections in the UK are no longer falling, with some parts of the country showing early signs of a possible increase, figures show. The rise is likely to have been caused by a jump in infections compatible with the original Omicron variant, BA1, along with the newer variants, BA4 and BA5. It comes as separate figures suggest the recent drop in the number of people in hospital with COVID-19 may also have come to a halt. A total of 989,800 people in private households in the UK are estimated to have had the virus in the week ending June the 2nd, up from 953,900 the previous week, according to the Office for National Statistics, ONS. In Scotland, 124,100 people were likely to have had the virus last week, or 1 in 40, up from 105,900, or 1 in 50. It is the first time total infections have risen week on week since the end of March, when the number hit a record 4.9 million at the peak of the Omicron BA2 wave. All four nations have seen a slight rise in the prevalence of the virus, though the ONS describes the trend in Scotland and Wales as uncertain. In England, 797,500 people were likely to test positive for COVID-19 last week, the equivalent of around 1 in 70. This is up week on week from 784,100, which was also around 1 in 70. Northern Ireland has seen infections rise for the second week in a row to stand at 27,700 people, or 1 in 65, up from 24,300 people, or 1 in 75. Wales has seen COVID-19 infections increase very slightly to an estimated 40,500 people, or 1 in 75, up from 39,600, also 1 in 75. Across all four UK countries, the percentage of people testing positive for COVID-19, compatible with Omicron variants BA1, BA4 and BA5, increased in the week ending June the 2nd, 2022, the ONS said. Omicron BA1 is the original variant of Omicron that caused a surge in infections across the UK in December and early January. BA4 and BA5 are newer variants that were recently classified by the UK Health Security Agency as variants of concern, after analysis found both were likely to have a growth advantage over BA2, which is still the dominant strain in the country. Initial findings suggest BA4 and BA5 have a degree of immune escape, meaning the immune system can no longer recognise or fight a virus, which is likely to contribute to their growth advantage over BA2, the UK HSA said. The latest estimates for COVID-19 infections come as separate figures show the recent fall in the number of people in hospital with the virus may have come to a stop. Some 4,082 patients in England had COVID-19 on June the 9th, up 6% on the previous week, while in Scotland, 637 patients were recorded on June the 5th, the latest data available, up 8% week on week. Patient numbers in both nations had previously been on a steady downwards trend since early April, following the peak of the Omicron BA2 wave. In Wales and Northern Ireland, the figures for people in hospital with the virus have levelled off in recent days. This article is by Jodie Harrison.
From the Herald Scotland, Friday the 10th of June 2022, from the sports section, age was no barrier to Curtis Cup glory for Bell of the Dimple Ball Game, by Nick Roger, golf correspondent. Are you scunnered by the coverage of the Saudi-backed LIV Golf International event and all its associated palafers yet? Yes? Well, that's good to know, because for the next 700 or so words, you can escape all that money-soaked kerfuffle and reflect on a more wholesome golfing occasion. Back in 1986, the good ladies of the Great Britain and Ireland Curtis Cup team managed to achieve a feat that was bigger than some of the cheques being dished out down at the Centurion Club, when they won an American turf for the first time in the biennial bout's history. No other Great Britain and Ireland side had managed to replicate that effort since, but the current crop, which includes the Scottish duo of Lise Duncan and Hannah Darling, will have another go at it this weekend when the transatlantic tussle takes place at a storied Merion in Pennsylvania. Things have changed a bit since 1986, of course. Bell Robertson, the celebrated and decorated Dunaverty golfer, is well aware of that. I think the oldest player competing this time will only be 23 or something, suggested the sprightly 86-year-old. Robertson was pretty close with their estimation. It's actually 22. I was 50 when I played in 1986, she gasps with a reflective chuckle. The idea of a 50-year-old playing these days is ridiculous. Robertson may have reached her half-century when she made her seventh and final playing appearance in the Curtis Cup at Prairie Dunes in Kansas 36 years ago, but those advancing years were certainly no barrier to success. She won both the Scottish Women's Match Play and Stroke Play titles that season, and an historic 13-5 victory in the Curtis Cup was the icing on the cake for Robertson, having suffered 6 losses as a player and 2 as a non-playing captain since her debut way back in 1960. We had a wonderful team, a great mix of youth and experience, and it was an utter joy, added Robertson with a kind of glowing sense of nostalgia that should have been accompanied by a tune from a Colliery brass band. The young ones would come into the team room for breakfast and say, "It's very quiet," and before you knew it, the radio was on, the TV was on, and the noise was blaring. They made you feel young again. You laughed with them. They gave you respect with a bit of cheek too, and you would do the same. It was a lovely mix. This mix of players wanted the only special concoction in the Great British and Ireland's armoury this week. It was so hot in Kansas, and in her preparations, her captain, Diane Bailey, had a long chat with the England football manager, Bobby Robson, about a drink he used during that year's World Cup in Mexico, recalled Robertson. It was a mix that helped combat all the salt you lost when you were sweating. The US players said it was our special medicine. Great Britain and Ireland certainly put on a special performance. Robertson and her playing partner, the Irish great Mary McKenna, aided the cause with a win and a half from their two foursomes matches as Great Britain and Ireland eased to a mighty conquest. I hold a putt of some 20 feet to grab a half on the second day, and the captain came up and said, "Will I let you go out in a high?" said Robertson about sitting out the single session. I said I'd be delighted. I would have struggled to have played a singles match straight away. I walked around watching in the afternoon and almost felt embarrassed for the Americans as we were so far ahead. An indefatigable campaigner, Robertson was the non-playing GB and Irish Curtis Cup skipper in both 1974 and 1976. but I always prefer playing in it, she stated. When I was captain, one of the young girls came up to me the day before it started and said, I'm awfully frightened I let you down. I said to her, I'm terrified I let you all down with my decisions. It was much better being a player. In 1986, Robertson was back in the front line and competing with wonderful aplomb. The whole team just clicked, she said. Hopefully, a new generation of Great Britain and Irish golfers can find a winning formula on US soil this weekend. And that was an article by golf correspondent Nick Roger. From the Herald Scotland, Friday the 10th of June 2022, from the sports section, Brentford make approach to Bologna for Scotland star Aaron Hickey, by Ewan Payton. Scotland starlet Aaron Hickey is the subject of interest from several Premier League clubs, according to reports. Brentford are said to have made an official approach for the versatile fullback. The Telegraph say that Bologna value the player at around €25 million. And the reporter Mike McGrath says that Brentford have stepped up their interest by making an official approach to the Serie A club. He tweeted, hashtag Brentford FC have made an approach for Bologna fullback Aaron Hickey. Other Premier League clubs are interested in Scotland international, but no other club-to-club contact yet. Player valued at around €25 million. Hearts fans will be keeping a keen eye on Hickey's future, with the club set for a sizeable sell-on fee as part of their deal with Bologna. And that article is by Ewan Payton.
Hello, this is your reader Jackie. This is the Herald on Monday the 13th of June 2022. News. Charity concern over campus cop spending. This article is by Andrew Learmonth. Children's charities and opposition parties have hit out after millions of pounds earmarked for closing the attainment gap were spent on so-called campus cops. Research by Aberlour found that nearly £2 million of pupil equity funding has been used to pay for police officers to patrol schools in Glasgow, West Lothian, North Ayrshire, Fife and South Lanarkshire. The money is supposed to be targeted at closing the attainment gap by improving the educational outcomes of children affected by poverty. Martin Canavan, head of policy at Aberlour, told The Sun that pupils should be benefiting from this help and support with their learning that this money provides. Freedom of information requests by the charity found 91 officers were stationed on school campuses across Scotland as of December 2021, compared to 71 8 years ago. Of the £1,985,100 spent since 2018, headteachers in Glasgow are responsible for £1 million, including £250,000 in 2020-2021 when schools were closed due to COVID. Mr. Canavan said, pupil equity funding is aimed at helping schools to reduce the poverty-related attainment gap. Children growing up in poverty and who are furthest from education should benefit from the help and support with their learning that this money provides. We know that children and their families thrive when they are able to determine what help and support they need in their lives. We are curious about the evidence base showing campus cops can improve children's learning. We remain unclear how children and their families have been involved in decisions about having police in their schools, which is why we continue to ask questions. Lib Dem education spokesperson Willie Rennie said the system is supposed to see £1,200 given to schools to raise the attainment of each child who needs it, to find huge amounts are instead being diverted to putting cops in corridors is shocking. I want to see this money go towards breakfast clubs, extra in-class support and more. That's how to help give children the best start in life. Instead, the cash that is supposed to support individual learning and development is going towards campus cops. It's hard to see how that will raise attainment. It took Scottish Liberal Democrats years to persuade the SNP to establish this funding for the poorest pupils. Funding was supposed to follow the child. Now we find it's being spent on hiring police to follow the child. Scottish Conservative Shadow Education Secretary Oliver Mundell said Nicola Sturgeon has completely failed on her promise to close the attainment gap in our schools. With misguided decisions like this, it is little wonder our pupils are not getting the best start in life. The First Minister insists education is her top priority, but serious questions have to be answered why this crucial funding has been diverted towards police officers to patrol our schools. The Pupil Equity Fund simply hasn't been delivered to the right places, and shamefully, it is our poorest pupils who are suffering the most on the SNP's watch. Nobody doubts the important work campus cops do, but ministers should guarantee that funding designed to close the attainment gap will always be used on furthering children's development in our schools. Glasgow City Council defended the policy. They said campus cops made an impact as positive influencers. A spokesperson said the decision to embed the officers as a crucial part of the school management team is made by our head teachers, and it is an integral part of Glasgow's successful early intervention policy in helping to build constructive relationships. A Scottish Government spokesperson said, "We are investing a record £1 billion through the Scottish Attainment Challenge in this Parliament to support children and young people impacted by poverty, including £520 million of pupil equity funding." Schools know their learners best. Head teachers are responsible for using pupil equity funding to enhance, scale and introduce new approaches to tackling the poverty-related attainment gap within the school, across the learning community or in partnership with local services. Following feedback from head teachers, we have, for the first time, confirmed school-level PEF allocations for each of the next 4 years. This provides more certainty for head teachers and support longer-term planning. While the money is issued directly to schools, with head teachers given full autonomy on how to spend it, the Scottish Government recommends that parents and carers, children and young people, are meaningfully involved in the planning process. Last year at Holyrood's Education, Children and Young People Committee warned that there was a lack of robust data on how PEF was spent. In a letter to Education Secretary Shirley Ann Somerville, MSPs called for an evaluation framework being put in place in order to allow an assessment to be made of spend on and of any outcomes that follow from that expenditure. This article is by Andrew Learmonth.
From the Glasgow Times, Monday the 13th of June 2022, from the sports section, Celtic in two-horse race to sign Brazilian midfielder Vinicius Souza, by Ewan Payton. Celtic are reportedly in a two-horse race to sign Brazilian midfielder Vinicius Souza. The 22-year-old has been linked with a move to Parkhead since the start of the transfer window on Friday. Talks between Ange Postecoglou's side and Belgian outfit Mechelen are said to be already underway. It's been claimed that the player has several offers on the table though. Now, TAT can report that Celtic are involved in a straight two-horse race with Fenerbahce for Souza. The Turkish giants are believed to be after a permanent deal, with the hoops more keen on an initial loan with a view to buy in the future. And that article was by Ewan Payton. From the Glasgow Times, Monday the 13th of June 2022, from the sports section, Rangers stars Calvin Bassey and Joe Aribo scooped Nigeria Bollards Awards, by Ewan Payton. Rangers stars Calvin Bassey and Joe Aribo have been recognised by Nigeria for their impressive form over the past season. The Jazz player were among the winners of the national team's annual Bollards Awards. Bassey had become a pivotal cog in Giovanni Van Bronckhorst Rangers starting 11, putting in a series of man-of-the-match performances, including in the Europa League final against Eintracht Frankfurt. This has led to serious transfer interest this summer, with a handful of Premier League sides said to be interested in the 23-year-old. And, with his rise to prominence, Bassey was awarded the Revelation of the Year gong at Nigerian ceremony on Saturday night. His club and international teammate Aribo was named Nigeria's Midfielder of the Year. Both players are currently away with their country on international duty in the latest round of fixtures. They will return to Rangers for pre-season at the end of this month, ahead of another big season. And that was a piece by Ewan Payton. From the Herald Scotland, Monday the 13th of June 2022, from the sports section, Rory McIlroy retains RBC Canadian Open title with superb final round of 62. Rory McIlroy has a superb final round of 62 to retain his RBC Canadian Open title before taking aim at Rebel Series chief Greg Norman. McIlroy, who started the day in a share of the lead with Tony Finau, hit 10 birdies in his 8th under par round to finish 2 shots clear of the American at 19 under and land his 21st PGA Tour crown. That is one more than Norman, the CEO of the Saudi-backed LIV Golf International Series, whose maiden tournament finished on Saturday. The PGA Tour has suspended its members who teed off in the event at the Centurion Club. "This is a day I'll remember for a long, long time," McIlroy said on his CBS after his victory at St George's Golf and Country Club in Toronto. 21st PGA Tour win, one more than someone else. That gave me a little incentive today, and I'm happy to get it done. Finau closed with a 64, as did Justin Thomas, who was 3rd and 15 under, while Justin Rose hit the best round of the day, a 10 under 60, earning him a share of 4th place, a shot further back. McIlroy finished with back-to-back birdies on the 17th and 18th, having drop shots in the 13th and 16th. He added, "It's incredible playing with Tony and JT, Thomas, today, two of the top players in the world, and all of us just playing the way we did." Victory was the Northern Irishman's first of the year, and he said, "I think after COVID I just needed a complete reset. I sort of rededicated myself to the game a little bit, sort of realised what made me happy and this makes me happy." Rose, who finished the day tied fourth with Sam Burns, had been on track to break 60, only to bogey the last in a round which featured 3 eagles and 7 birdies. And that piece was unattributed. From the Herald Scotland, Monday the 13th of June 2022, from the sports section, Sir Alex Ferguson contends Ange Postecoglou Manager of the Year award as he reveals his winner. By Aidan Smith. Sir Alex Ferguson believes our both boss Dick Campbell should have landed the Manager of the Year award ahead of Ange Postecoglou. The Celtic manager scooped the Scottish Football Writers Award and the PFA gong after winning the Premiership title with the Hoops. For Sir Alex though, he reckons Campbell's promotion push with part-time Arbroath was more of an achievement. Legendary Manchester United boss recorded a video message for his old pal ahead of the Evening with Dick Campbell show at Glasgow St Luke's venue. He said, "Dick, in tribute to you tonight in front of a great audience, Tom Callaghan has been asking questions about you. I could give a few myself, but I don't want to embarrass you tonight. What a great season you've had, Dick. I said, when I told you the other day, you should have been Manager of the Year." Arbroath narrowly missed out on promotion to the Scottish Premiership after finishing just 2 points behind Kilmarnock. And that was a piece by Aidan Smith. From the Herald Scotland, Monday the 13th of June 2022, from the Voices section, Agenda, offshore wind can deliver for the climate and nature, but we need to get moving faster. An agenda piece by Alex Meredith. Scotland has one of the best offshore wind resources in the world. This is a decade we can harness it. It is not just the climate emergency and the urgency required towards decarbonisation that we must consider. The war in Ukraine has illustrated the need to enhance our energy security and self-sufficiency here in the UK and move beyond over-reliance on fossil fuels. The UK's record in getting offshore wind projects up and running in recent years has been mixed. We have not matched our potential with delivery and projects have been slow to come to fruition. We now have the opportunity to step up the speed and scale and bring forward world-leading projects that can be delivered this decade, providing fast, practical solutions to the climate crisis. Berwick Bank, on the outer Firth of Forth, will be one of the largest offshore renewable energy developments in the world, and the project is critical to meeting the UK and Scottish Government's 2030 offshore wind targets. It represents a huge opportunity to secure multi-billion pound investment in the Scottish supply chain and will ultimately generate enough clean, renewable energy to power a bit more than 5 million homes, equivalent to supplying all of Scotland's households twice over. The project will be consented by Scottish Government, which has been at the forefront of the drive towards renewables. The UK Government has also signalled its support for offshore wind projects as part of its recently published energy strategy about how to streamline the approval process. We have been urging both UK and Scottish Governments to help us move quickly to deliver the projects the country needs. One of the key ways to do that is to work with regulators and stakeholders in the early stages of development to identify potential sticking points and address them before the planning application is made. For example, at Berwick Bank, we have been in discussions with groups including the RSPB and Scottish Fishers regarding our ecosystem approach to dealing with the management of seabird populations. That is why we will be proposing to halt to sand eel fishing, which the birds feed on, in key parts of the North Sea, to ensure populations can thrive in the years ahead. Implementing this measure would result in a huge net gain for Scottish seabirds as a result of the delivery of Berwick Bank. It's a win-win. SSE Renewables has already proposed additional measures to protect birds, such as raising the minimum height of the turbine blades from 22 metres to 37 metres above sea level, to adjust for bird passage through the site. Time is of the essence. A fast consenting process can give confidence to investors and supply chains, so investments can be made in the Scottish and UK economy to create much needed high value green jobs. By consenting Berwick Bank and delivering the closure of sand eel fishing, we can show the world Scotland has a positive solution for its regulatory environment that will allow offshore development and our iconic seabirds to thrive. By Alex Meredith, who is the project director at SSE Renewables Berwick Bank Wind Project, and that article was read by myself, Ian McKenna. From the Herald Scotland, Monday the 13th of June 2022, from the Voices section, Doug Marr, we need to heed the lessons of history in defence of democracy. SNP MP Marie Black recently delivered a 4-minute speech in the Commons warning of the threat presented by the F word. No, not that F word. Fascism and anti-democratic tendencies in general were what she had in mind. Her argument was coherent and passionate, qualities usually absent from what passes as oratory and debate in parliaments north and south of the border. At a basic level, it was a notable piece of anti-Tory invective. It was a pity that it was delivered to a near-empty government benches. Reaction was mixed. Fellow columnist Kevin McKenna, for example, felt she spoke simply to win further approbation from her social media followers. He added, as an occupant of the SNP Glass House, Mrs. Black should be very wary of throwing stones about latent fascism in other places. Whatever one feels about what Mrs. Black said and how she said it, her words were a reminder that democracy is on the back foot in virtually every part of the world. Authoritarian and anti-democratic regimes in Russia and China seek to restore or expand their spheres of influence in Europe, Africa and the Pacific. Regimes with similar tendencies have emerged in Hungary, Turkey and Poland. Populists are increasingly voluble in parts of Western Europe, including France, Belgium and the Netherlands. These voices are a reminder that democracy is fragile and cannot be taken for granted. In How Democracy Dies, Stephen Levitsky and Daniel Ziblatt offer 4 indicators of authoritarian behaviours that threaten democracy. These include a refusal to play by the rules, for example rejecting the outcome of elections, accusing opponents of criminal acts, encouraging or refusing to condemn violence, curtailing civil liberties and undermining media freedom and independence. In her book, Putin's People, Catherine Belton describes how Vladimir Putin muted opposition and criticism by targeting and then seizing control of the media. Similarly, ex-President Trump attacked the Washington Post and CNN, describing the media as being amongst the most dishonest human beings on earth. Critical media coverage became fake news. The legitimacy of political opponents, including President Obama and Hillary Clinton, was disputed. In Mr. Trump's eyes, President Obama wasn't an American citizen, and Mrs. Clinton should be locked up. Mr. Trump was ambivalent about violence of the so-called Proud Boys, and appeared to condone the roughing up of hecklers and, oh yes, the Mussolini-like march on the Capitol. Levitsky and Ziblatt argue that Trump's election was a milestone in the loss of what they describe as mutual toleration and institutional forbearance. These being the unwritten rules and norms that lubricate the workings of democracy. When there is mutual toleration, politicians recognise opponents' views are legitimate and opposition is not necessarily subversion. Institutional forbearance prevents weaponisation of the institutions of state, such as elections, parliaments and assemblies, the law and the courts, to frustrate or suppress opposition voices. Democracy is in trouble when unwritten rules and norms are overwritten for partisan gain. In the USA, for example, Supreme Court appointments became a partisan battleground, intended to stymie opponents. I hear you say, this is the UK, not Russia, China, or even the USA. We're exceptional, aren't we? Perhaps, but in the absence of a written constitution, the unwritten rules and norms of democracy, what can be described as gentlemen's agreements, are particularly important. Are ours robust enough to swim against the rising tide of worldwide authoritarianism and populism? There's little room for complacency. A 2022 survey of democratic well-being by Carnegie UK suggested that more than 40% of people in England believe democracy isn't working. They feel strongly that politics and politicians can't be believed and have lost their respect. In the words of Hannah Arendt, truth and politics have never been in good terms. There is ample evidence that all-important political mutual tolerance and institutional forbearance in the UK are being eroded. They were worn down by the Scottish independence referendum, Brexit, and loose talk of enemies of the people and traitors. Boris Johnson's proroguing of Parliament for 5 weeks in 2019 was an attack on institutional forbearance. The Police, Crime, Sentencing and Courts Act limits the democratic right to protest. Proposals for compulsory photographic ID at UK polling stations would disenfranchise an estimated 25% of the electorate lacking the necessary documentation and unlikely to be Tory voters. As the Tory party melts down, there is genuine danger that the authoritarian right will seize control and reassert the opportunity to introduce regressive social and economic policies that represent a threat to democracy. Democracy only flourishes where there's a dialogue and politicians engage, respect and listen to one another. The preservation of democracy is far more important than the divisiveness of partisan politics. As Marie Black pointed out, democracies don't expire because they're extinguished by revolutionary authoritarianisms. They die because norms and safeguards are eroded step by step. In time they become so weak they're unable to resist the emergence of populist strongmen and regimes. Even in the exceptional UK, we need to heed the lessons of history. Our columns are a platform for writers to express their opinions. They do not necessarily represent the views of the Herald. And that opinion piece was by Doug Marr.
Recorded from the Herald on the 14th of June 2022, from the sports section, Armenia 1, Scotland 4. Stuart Armstrong nets double as Steve Clark's men bounce back from Dublin loss in style, by Matthew Lindsay, recorded by Amy. A first-half Stuart Armstrong double and strikes from John McGinn and Che Adams in the second ensured Scotland bounced back from their weekend mauling by the Republic of Ireland with an emphatic victory over Armenia in Yerevan tonight. The national team, whose manager Steve Clark has come under pressure following the defeats to Ukraine in the Qatar 2022 playoff semi-final earlier this month, and Ireland on Saturday, fell behind in the 6th minute when Vahan Bichakachayan scored. But Armstrong soon restored parity in the Nations League match in the Vazgen Sarsgen Republican Stadium and put his side 2-1 ahead in added time at the end of the opening 45 minutes after Arman Hovindyason had been sent off for a headbutt on John McGinn. McGinn and Adams got their names on the score sheet within 8 minutes of play restarting, and Scotland recorded a comfortable and much-needed victory, which keeps alive their hopes of topping Group B1 and securing a Euro 2024 playoff spot. The softness of the goals that Scotland had conceded against Ireland 3 days ago had been alarming, but there was no tangible improvement early on this evening. The opener was a result of a catalogue of errors. Grant Hanley should have put the ball out for a throw-in when he was attempting to halt Tigran Barishkin wide on the left touchline, but he failed to do so and his opponent jinked forward and cut inside into the penalty area. Hansley's fellow centre-backs Jack Hendry and Scott McTominay both, for reasons best known to themselves, stood off to the midfielder who squared to Bichakachayan in the 6-yard box. His teammate had the simplest of tasks to side-foot beyond Craig Gordon. Manchester United player McTominay was badly at fault for failing to block the near post. He looked very much like a midfielder playing out of position at centre-half. The travelling supporters who made the long journey to Yerevan must have feared that a rerun of the weekend horror show was on the cards. But the visitors kept their cool and deservedly drew level just 8 minutes later. Hendry picked out Adams with chip and striker controlled the ball and attempted an overhead kick. He miscued his effort, but Armstrong, who had misplaced Christie in the starting lineup, bust forward and made no mistake. It was the Southampton man's first goal for this country since a Euro 2020 qualifier against San Marino and Hampden back in 2019. His return to the score sheet was timely. However, the equaliser did nothing to lift Scotland or deflate Armenia. Quite the opposite was the case, in fact. McGinn, who donned the captain's armband in the absence of the injured Andy Robertson and his teammates, were highly fortunate not to fall behind for a second time. Corin Baramayan had the ball in the net 4 minutes later, only for a Montenegrin referee, Nikola Dabonovic, to disallow it for offside following a VAR check. It was the correct decision, still the ease with which the winger got forward was worrying. Hendry made a crucial clearance just as Barsegian was poised to shoot as he lay on the turf after Baramayan had chipped over the heads of the three men backline. Edward Spertzian got a follow-up shot away but failed to find the target. Adams had been a shadow of the player who scored against Moldova and Denmark in Qatar 2022 qualifiers earlier this season in this international break. But he fired just wide from distance and came close to chipping goalkeeper David Yurachenko as Scotland rallied slightly. Then Hovindyason had his moment of madness. He skiffed down Nathan Patterson as the right wing bust upfield. McGinn squared up to the defender and made his unhappiness at the shocking challenge clear. His rival headbutted him just a couple of yards away from the match official. He could have been shown straight red cards for either incident, but Dabonovic brandished the 2 yellow red cards in quick succession. Armenia were reduced to 10 men. They fell behind just 2 minutes later following a well-worked Scotland attack. McGregor and McGinn combined to supply Armstrong and their teammate took 2 touches inside Varadasaharian before firing into the bottom right corner. It was a stunning finish which further justified his selection ahead of Christie. Fan favourites McGinn had not been his usual self in front of goal this month. He spurned gilt-edged opportunities against both Ukraine and the Republic of Ireland, but he atoned for those misses by bagging Scotland's 3rd 5 minutes into the second half. Greg Taylor overlapped down the left before sending a cross into the far post. Patterson met the delivery first time and fed McGinn. The Aston Villa man controlled the pass and then spun and fired into the bottom left corner. Adams got into the act 3 minutes later after being sent through on goal by Armstrong. He had much work to do and showed great composure to cut inside Stropa Mrchajan and then beat Yurchenko. With Scotland 3 goals ahead and victory assured, Clark made a triple substitution. He took off McGinn, Patterson and Billy Gilmore and put on David Turnbull, Anthony Rilson and Lewis Ferguson respectively. And Jacob Brown took over from Adams in the closing stages and Alan Campbell came on for Hanley later on. Armenia skipper Kamo Hovhaniemi was red carded in the final minute for a shocking challenge on Ferguson as tempers flared, but nothing could take the shine off a hugely satisfactory night for Scotland. The article was by Matthew Lindsay and recorded by Amy. Recorded from the Herald on the 14th of June 2022, from the sports section, recorded by Amy. Jack Ross pinpointed by Dundee United as Tam Corrett's replacement as talks begin, by Aidan Smith. Jack Ross has been pinpointed as Dundee United's preferred candidate to replace the departing Tam Corrett, according to reports. The Tannadice outfit confirmed today that their manager had exited the club and it is widely expected that he will link up with Croatian outfit Reka. United sporting director Tony Ashgar has already begun the recruitment process to replace Corrett and an announcement is expected in the upcoming days. The Courier state that the Terriers' number one target is former Hibernian boss Jack Ross, who has been out of work since being sacked at Easter Road in December last year. The 46-year-old was axed after a run of 7 defeats in the 9 league games. He has recently been linked with a Dundee job, but after turning the role down, a move to Tannadice could be on the cards. Ashgar said today, "I'd like to place on record our gratitude towards Tam Corrett for the service he has given Dundee United, both as head coach and in his previous role as head of tactical performance. We made a brave appointment last year by promoting from within, but it was a calculated risk that clearly paid off. We enjoyed a lot of success on the field last year and qualified for Europe. This is testament to the culture we have created throughout the club. Tam bought into our long-term strategy to develop some of the finest young talent in Scotland. The fruits of our labour are there for all to see with recent international call-ups of Archie, Kieran and Ross. But through the course of discussions with Tam, it became clear he was keen to pursue other options and we had to look after the best interests of the club. Following continued discussion, we have now agreed to mutually terminate his contract to allow him time to secure his next opportunity. He leaves with our best wishes, but I would like to assure Dundee United fans that the club is moving in a timely fashion to appoint a new head coach. We have identified a preferred candidate and we anticipate making a further announcement on this in the coming days." The article was by Aidan Smith and recorded by Amy.
From the Herald Scotland, Tuesday the 14th of June 2022, from the Voices section, Brian Wilson, "We should all be grateful to Audit Scotland for holding government to account. It should not come as a surprise that Audit Scotland is having its budget slashed at a time when its role has never been more necessary. Identifying inefficiencies in order to free up money for supposed priorities. In today's Scotland, watchdogs are not supposed to bark, and Audit Scotland has become a persistent nuisance. Most conspicuously, its report on the Ferguson Ferry scandal was a game changer, cutting through deceptions and blame passing that have characterised that sorry affair. As a result of its report, which fingered political motivation for running through the contract, Holyrood's Audit Committee is now conducting its own inquiry. Its findings are unlikely to make happy reading for ministers who had fingers in that particular pie, Swinney, Brown and Sturgeon herself, never mind the departed Fall Guy, Derek Mackay. Audit Scotland does its job without political fear or favour, and we should be grateful to it. This makes it a very rare animal in the sprawling, interlinked network of Scotland's quangle and patronage circuit, where future appointments and funding are dependent on current compliance. And, before you ask, no, it wasn't always like that. To take another example, I looked at Audit Scotland's latest report on the performance of local councils and came upon a gem of information that, since 2010, library services have suffered a 29% cut in investment, while library closures have shone a light on digital exclusion. Scotland's quangos are not meant to shine lights on anything inconvenient. Ms Sturgeon's policy on libraries is to have the occasional photo opportunity, holding a book while surrounded by little children. The fact libraries have been closing and reducing hours long before the pandemic as cuts in council funding bit does not fit that script. So thank you, Audit Scotland. Just to reinforce its point, their report states, while the digital offer will shape the future of library services, research shows that buildings are vital as safe, accessible, free, trusted, and communal space in communities. Thank you again, Audit Scotland, for making a statement which would, in an open, progressive society, become the stuff of political debate and media coverage. But do we live in such a society? At this point, I recalled a blog by one of the thoughtful independence campaigners, Robert McAlpine, that was forwarded to me last week. He approaches these matters from a different perspective to mine in the Constitution, but that does not make it impossible to agree when it comes to an analysis of how Scotland has run under Ms. Sturgeon's drab, but, when it comes to self-protection, highly efficient regime. Mr. McAlpine defined the motto of the Sturgeon era as, "Be the hand that feeds and demand no biting." He recalled the early appearance of Naomi Klein as poverty czar and her abrupt disappearance when she didn't get the no biting memo as a clear and chilling warning from the beginning. "Cower and I will bestow riches upon you. Rise against me and you will be destroyed." Mr. McAlpine continued, "Scotland is now a cartel of public agencies, NGOs, private interests and consultants and a host of ancillary services, all willing to keep their mouths shut in return for a generous payment. There is barely a day goes by when the government doesn't announce another vat of gravy for the train." If you want any given group of public sector insiders to start telling the media that your government is doing a good job, you simply create a £50 million fund and ask them to bid for it. These bits never go to anyone not already soaked in gravy. I have no wish to embarrass Mr. McAlpine, but he is spot on with that critique, and a lot of people who have been complicit in allowing it to develop should examine their consciences. How often have I heard the sheepish apology? "I can't see anything because we're dependent on them for funding, and they're ruthless." The need for scrutiny of how the Scottish Government's very generous resources are spent has been given new urgency by the austerity package signalled by the Finance Secretary Kate Forbes, which envisages a huge further cut to local authorities and hence the services they provide. Ms. Forbes blamed the £3.5 billion black hole on the funding settlement for Westminster, the traditional cry to relieve the Scottish Government of any responsibility. Her claim of a 5.2% cut in this year's budget is wholly dependent on including the emergency funding for COVID as the baseline, which only a knave or a fool would claim is legitimate. Ms. Forbes is not a fool. Without that pretense, the budget has increased and will rise further as Barrett consequentials arrive during the course of the year, as they always do. If there is indeed a £3.5 billion black hole, then it is entirely due to spending decisions taken in Edinburgh and the refusal to recognise that politics is the language of priorities in Scotland, just like anywhere else. What we saw recently was not a real spending review, but a crude piece of axe-wielding. Again, I can scarcely improve from Robert McAlpine's summary. The Scottish Government's austerity budget was not inevitable. It is the price Scotland will pay for 7 years of poor quality, visionless government. While he and I disagree respectively about the desired destination, we seem to be on exactly the same page about the nature of the journey. These years could have been spent on making Scotland a far better, more socially just society to live in. Deep-rooted problems could have been addressed with serious radical intent. It hasn't happened, and anyone who dared to challenge was deemed an enemy. It is not Audit Scotland's job to be a political opposition, and this has never come close to crossing that line. It has just done its job and declined to be cowed. More power to its elbow, now and in the future, no matter who's in government. And incidentally, its annual budget is barely half of what has been committed to preparing for a referendum that only 30% want and isn't going to happen. Priorities? An opinion piece by Brian Wilson. Our columns are a platform for writers to express their opinions. They do not necessarily represent the views of the Herald. And that article was read to you today by me, Ian McKenna.
And that was this week's The Herald podcast, normally recorded in our studio at the Bishop Briggs Media Centre, currently recorded from our volunteers' homes with the publisher's kind permission. Thanks for listening.